house a couple of years ago when we were renting, you may have noticed there was a distinct smell coming from the attic. And that was for a season because we could hear this, you know, this scratching in the winter. And we told our landlord, and think, you know, squirrels, raccoons, we don't know what's up there. He lived out of town, wasn't really his concern. And so he said, just don't worry about it. So we had roommates for a while and tried to be optimistic. You know, it's like we have these cool pets that we don't have to feed or take to the vet, trying to be optimistic. And then the winter, you know, went and they went back outside. And so out of sight, out of mind, no big deal. But as these things often do, they remember where to go when it gets cold. So the next winter they came back, and man, did they come back with a vengeance. And so we could hear all across the top of our house these things. So we told the landlord, like, you gotta do something about this. So we called a guy to come in and seal up the gap where they were getting in, which was great. No new animals could get in. Not so great, no animals could get out. So they continued to make noise, and until eventually they didn't make noise anymore. And so when we got up there, it was horrendous. And I don't really want to describe it because it was that bad. The thing was, this wasn't an issue that just, you know, a little bit of Lysol would help or a little Febreze. This was something that needed to be cleaned up, disinfected, absolutely removed. There was no masking this, because the thing was, the problem was out of sight, but it wasn't out of smell, because it spread. And it came through the house, and sight, you know, you can hide something ugly from sight. Something that stinks, you can't contain. It just spreads, and it spreads, and it spreads. And sin in our lives can be a lot like rats in the attic, in that maybe we can hide it, you know, from sight. People don't look at us and see what's going on, but they can smell something. You know, something's up. It permeates, and it affects. It affects our relationships, friendships, marriages, families, our relationship with God. The sin in our lives, which, yes, we have the ability oftentimes to hide from sight, is something that does continue to have an effect that is kind of nasty and permeates all of lives. And if we look at our lives, pretty much, I think I've met two types of people before. Those who are honest and struggle, that say, you know, I struggle with something that I do that I don't want to do, and those who lie and say they don't. Because we've got these things that are common to us, and we look at our lives, we can honest something, and we know, you know, whether it's something like, I've got to stop being so angry, or I've got to stop building the web of lies that I've built, or I've got to stop, you know, looking at that stuff I do on the computer, or doing that thing with my girlfriend, or every time I get together talking about people, being a gossiper and a slanderer. All these habits that we have, you can call them vices, addictions, or just areas in which we lack self-control, but are sinful, they start to stink eventually. And they start to permeate the different areas of our lives. And it's not like it just happens in a small compartment of our life and then we can close it off there, right? It's not, yeah, we can maybe hide it from people, but its effects kind of spread. And so even though you can't see it, it's something there that is damaging. And we look at our lives and sometimes we say, you know, I've got this thing, I can see the damage that it's causing. And maybe others can't identify what it is exactly that's going on, but they can sense it too. And we look at it, but we want to keep it. Like we just desperately want to keep it. We can't imagine getting rid of it. And so instead of removing it, we'd rather just mask it. You know, if we spritz a little perfume over it, that'll cover it. If I've got this bad thing going on over here, I will just increase the amount of good that I do and kind of pile it all on top, and it will cover it up. It will mask it. And we kind of operate like that for a while, or maybe we find a way to blame others and think, you know I should be less angry, but the reality is I don't have an anger problem. You have a making me angry problem, and you need to get on fixing that, because this isn't my fault. This isn't, you know, I understand I should be doing something different, but really you're the one who needs to stop egging me on. And we can blame others, and so we find ways to justify or excuse or try and cover up. And whether we want to label it, you know, to the degree that it is an addiction of sorts, or whether it's an area where there's a lack of self-control in an area of sin in our lives, there are things, I think, which we would all admit to someone in confidence that we trust that we hate doing, which we can't seem to stop doing. And this can cause us some pretty devastating feelings. And we just sang about two of them, and that without Christ, you know, our shame is great. And shame is a huge oppressor of people. We are so ashamed of what's going on, and not only are we ashamed, we're also hopeless. And we feel this shame because I know what goes on in here, right? Like, maybe I can hide it from all of you guys, but I know what's going on in here, and I know God knows what's going on in here. And regardless of whether or not anybody else is seeing it or sensing it, I feel ashamed of the things that I do in secret. And even though I've tried to stop 1,000 times, I keep going back to the same things. And that really is the source of my hopelessness, is that, yes, I've tried. I know the difference between right and wrong. I know what I hate doing, and yet I continue to do it. I've tried to stop 1,000 times, and exactly 1,000 times I have failed to overcome this. And so I'm feeling shame, and I'm feeling hopelessness, and that's a tough place to be. And so we have these struggles, and we kind of work through them, but the good news and the hope of the rest of that verse is that although our shame is great, Jesus is greater. Although our sin is strong, Jesus is stronger. And we have hope that we don't need to wear that shame, and we don't need to feel that hopelessness because of the power of Christ. And that happens for a lot of reasons. First, that we don't struggle alone. Like we're not alone. We make sin really private, but it's not something that we have to struggle with alone. Some of the most godly people all through history have struggled with the same kinds of things that you deal with. They have been given to sexual sin and habits of sin, patterns and coping mechanisms which are sinful, and relational ways of relating to people which are seen as sin, whether it be gossip or slander or lying or cheating or whatever, ways of offending people. All through time, the people of great, you know, godly character have fallen again and again and again, but have also got up again and again and again by the grace and mercy of God. And we look at the New Testament part of our Bible, and a guy named Paul wrote a good chunk of it, and he confessed what this is like in a way that I'm going to encourage you to follow the train of thought. It can be easy to get lost in the wording of it, but this is a confession that he makes about what's like to have sin. Although he was a godly man, a respectable man, sin and temptation had this way of luring him away from doing what he knew was right. He wrote it this way, and follow it. He said, "I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. But as it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is, in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil that I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it is no longer I to do it, but it is sin living in me that does it. So I find this law at work. Although I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being, I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within me. What a wretched man am I, who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death? The answer to that question is Jesus. But I don't know about you, but there is something very personally, like resonate, that I just resonate so deeply with that. The thing that I want to do, I can't do. And the thing that I don't want to do, I just keep on doing it. And he teaches us here that there is a spiritual battle. That although there is God's law, which is good, which he delights in, to be obedient and submissive to God, there is another law at work within him. The one that wages war against his desire to do what's right in God's eyes. And that is the law of sin at work in him. For every inclination to do what is good, he's got evil right there beside him. He recognizes that. He feels that. He battles with that. And he fails because of that. And he confesses it. And what's going on is this spiritual battle that is fighting for the allegiances of your heart. And it's not seen with our eyes. We don't look up to the heavens and see this battle going on, but its effects are quite easily seen as we wrestle in this way and identify with what he's saying. It's like the wind of a hurricane. You can't see it, but its effect, its trail of destruction, makes it very clear that it is real, that it is an actual thing that has taken place. And fighting against you and your desire to be godly is all the powers of darkness, which is kind of overwhelming. Satan and his demons are fighting against you and I as we pursue righteousness. The book of Ephesians says it this way. It says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God." Why? So that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes, which is obviously presupposing that the devil is alive and scheming against you. See, our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's not against people. Our struggle is against the rulers and the authorities and against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. That's what's going on in the unseen world, a fight for allegiance between good and evil, for the allegiances of your heart. And unfortunately for us, in their corner fighting against you and God's desire for you is your very own sinful nature. And so you've got this battle going on the outside, but you've also got a battle going on the inside, because we have a corruption that is in us that gives us a proclivity to rebellion against God, a desire to sin. And sin, it entered the world through one man, right? It came through Adam, and as a result, it's part of all of us. We've consciously chosen, we've engaged in sin, we all have a sinful nature. It came through one man, Adam. It's been removed by one man, the new Adam, Jesus Christ. So sin came into the world through one man, and so did love and eternal life and forgiveness come through another man. But the thing is, the sin that came through Adam has automatically been transferred to all mankind. We live with it, we die with it. I mean, it's part of who we are. But the forgiveness and the grace and the eternal life that is available through Jesus is not an automatic. We all have a sin nature in us that is waging war in us. We're not all forgiven and set free from the power of sin and its eternal consequences. That is for those who place their faith in Jesus as the Son of God. And so while all are negatively affected by Adam and have a sinful nature, not all are automatically saved through Jesus' sacrifice, but we can all have a recognition that there is a law of sin at work against us. It eggs us on. It calls out to us in the darkness to pursue our own sinful passions, our own desires, and to rebel against God and his ways. And meanwhile, we've got this will that God has for us to be self-controlled, to be pure, to be holy as God is holy. This is what we've been called to do. And with all my heart, I want to do that, right? And maybe you're feeling the same way. I want to, desperately, I want to, but I just can't seem to. It's like going to the gym. Like this week I had a meeting and I thought, when I get home, I'm going to go upstairs, put on different clothes, and go to the gym. That's the plan. 10 minutes later, on the couch, big bowl of ice cream, that hardening chocolate on top, it was so good. But that's the reality, right? But I can. I can sometimes make myself go to the gym. It happens occasionally. And so that's not quite the same thing. Maybe more of an accurate description is that when I'm at the gym, I would love to be able to curl a 50. I would love to be able to curl a 50, but I can't. I absolutely cannot. When it comes to getting to the gym, sometimes I win, sometimes I lose the battle. But when I'm there, I can never lift a 50. No matter how bad I want to, I can't even curl half that. And that's more like what sin is like in our life. The ability to conquer it without the power of Christ, it's just not going to happen. It is not something that we can do. I'm completely and utterly incapable of curling that 50. And when it comes to beating the power of sin and its eternal consequence in our life, on our own, we don't have the power, the capability to do so. Enter the grace of God. So if you can identify with what Paul wrote, that I do what I do not want to do, and the good that I know I should do, I just can't seem to do it. Well, it makes sense when we see the spiritual perspective of what's going on. Because Satan is alive and well and wants to destroy you. He's described in 1 Peter. It says, be alert and of sober mind, because your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. That is the picture of Satan, alive and well and with a mission to destroy you. And his intent? Well, Jesus describes that in John 10:10, that he is a thief who comes to steal and kill and destroy. That is what this roaring lion is looking to do, to steal and kill and destroy you. And while that's going on, while Satan is busy doing that, there is all the powers of evil in the heavenly realms fighting a battle, which we read before. They're fighting a battle, and that is what is really waging war against you. And so while Satan is busy doing that, and the powers of evil are fighting against you, this is all outside you, then our sinful nature gets involved on the inside. The part of us where we have given ourselves over to evil, and this spiritual battle on the inside is written about in James. It says, we end up doing what we hate. When we're tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, because God isn't tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they're dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. And certainly, when it comes especially to the cycles of addiction, this is exactly how it goes. The idea, you think the idea, and you already know you're toast. You've already kind of made up your mind about, well, you haven't even sinned yet, but you've kind of, you know, actually engaged in something, but you've and maybe you can identify, I've thought about it, and well, I'm toast. Because I know I'm going to end up there. I mean, I know I'm going to go and look that thing up. I know I just have to let this tidbit of gossip out, because the idea of holding it in compared to how good it would feel to let it out, that's just not going to happen. And so we've got these battles on the outside, battles on the inside, and then we've even got our own biology fighting against us. And this is, I know it's outside of my realm of expertise, I'll do my best, because I went to a seminar a little while back called Pastoral Approaches to Helping Those Who Are Struggling with Sexually Addictive Behavior. And it shows this cycle of addiction, and it does so with an explanation as to kind of what's going on physically and biochemically in the mind as you engage in this. So I've got a chart here. It's from Fight the New Drug, which is recognition of pornography as an addiction, and kind of going through it. So you'd experience something comfortable and then enter into this, you know, autopilot mode of going through this cycle of addiction. And in your brain, the first thing would happen, you'd kind of entertain a trigger would happen. So we'll get the first one up there. When a trigger happens, the next one, there it is. When a trigger happens, you kind of, whether it's pain or a sense of wanting to escape, adrenaline will happen, fight or flight, you know, will kick in. Often you want to flight and escape into the world of whatever sin or whatever, you know, drug of choice helps cope your pain. Then you move on to kind of this idea where you're moving towards using, you're rationalizing. So when you're rationalizing, you're saying, okay, well, so-and-so did this to me, and so I deserve to do this, or I was good, so I deserve to reward myself with this, or somehow explaining how what you're doing is not so bad. You rationalize in your mind, you find a way to justify it, and dopamine kicks in, and that's part of the reward cycle system of the brain, and it's going to encourage you and motivate you to go on and satisfy that craving, do what feels good, because there's more chemicals to come that it wants you to enjoy. And so you'd move towards using, and you'd get to this ritualization, which is where you're starting to engage in it. Okay, so maybe you haven't actually acted out, you haven't put the thing into your body yet, you haven't seen the thing, but you're driving to the liquor store, or you're logging onto the computer, you're entering the ritual, and when that's happening, you've got endorphins, which give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. And they're also great for numbing pain. And so they're playing their role, and then that moves you on, and you get to this point where you act out, or you use. And when that happens, studies have found that oxytocin is something that's released, which is some refer to as a love hormone. Happens between mothers and kids during breastfeeding. It happens during sex. It's a bonding thing. It's meant to bond people, as far as I understand. And so how this is incredibly dangerous is that you can, you know, learn to be bonded and make these connections with the highly addictive and sinful behaviors. And so all through this thing, I mean, your body, it's just your biology is just going along for the ride. It's just enjoying the ride of whatever it is. And as this cycle goes on, your body is building a tolerance to it. It fuels our desire to sin more and more significantly. In the case of a drug addiction, the National Institute on Drug Abuse wrote, as a person continues to use drugs, the brain adjusts to the excess dopamine that's being produced by making less of it or reducing the abilities of cells in the reward circuit to respond to it. This reduces the high that the person feels compared to the high they felt when first taking the drug, an effect known as tolerance. They might take more of the drug trying to achieve the same dopamine high. Some will describe this, and this is related to sin, all right? We're not separating it out into other things. Talking about sin, and there's a law of diminishing returns, that if you're kind of trucking along here and you feel a need to escape where you're at, and so you'll take something that gives you high and you go up, but then you drop down lower than you were before. Then the next time you take it, the same amount, but you don't go quite as high as you did the first time. You're kind of around here, and you continue on that cycle until eventually your high is still lower than the original place you were. And hence the ongoing and increased need to use or to abuse whatever it is that you engage in. You put it all together. Like, it's no wonder, even if I know what's right and wrong, that's no guarantee that I'm going to do what's right. Knowing it, I mean, we've got Satan fighting against us, the powers of evil fighting against us, our sinful nature fighting against us, in some cases, our biology supporting the process of us rebelling against God. This is what's going on. And so what hope do we possibly have? Well, it's a hope that's not all tied up in ourselves. It's the hope in Christ. And that's where that selection of songs was perfect. Because it is all about, as powerful and devastating as sin is, Jesus is all the more powerful. We have hope in the one who came to give us life and life to the full. We looked earlier at what Jesus said. It was him who said, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Speaking of Satan and those who would do his work on his behalf. But Jesus wasn't done with that sentence. He went on to say, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. And this life to the full is a life of freedom. It's freedom from the shame that we experience because of the sins that we've committed. It is freedom from the hopelessness of believing and being stuck believing that we can't possibly overcome this. It's freedom in actually experiencing victory. And anytime, even if you've fallen since, anytime you have experienced victory over sin that for a long time had victory over you, it is a beautiful thing, is it not? By the grace of God. And yet, often we continue to struggle, we go back, and we can have hope to get out. I mean, a lot of times we'd like for sin to let us go. That if we tap out, it would let us go, it would release its grip. When me and the guys were in the dorm living, we had hall brawls. So it was upstairs versus downstairs. Everybody would kind of, you know, put a little face paint on and undershirts, and the, you know, we'd go downstairs, and the 20 guys who lived downstairs would be there, and us upstairs guys would be over here, and you'd run at each other, and the hall's only 30 inches wide, and the goal is to make the other floor tap out. And so it's not punching and kicking necessarily, but it's arm bars and choke holds and whatever you can do to get them to tap out. And so, you know, mostly it's pretty even. Everybody, you know, everybody's even, except for the one gigantic, psychotic, really strong guy who was choking everybody out in a way that was actually literally crushing their windpipes. So here's this guy, and it didn't matter. Like, everybody's going, he just walks around, holds you, chokes you. You'd tap out, but he wouldn't let go. You'd tap, and he'd hold for 3, 5, 10 more seconds. Like he really was into this. And we had to make several trips, an hour-long drive to the hospital, because people turned green. I have never seen people turn green. We literally had to take people into the hospital, and they were diagnosed that they had a slightly crushed windpipe from this guy. And sometimes with sin, we just, you know, we give up. I'm done. I'm tapping. I'm not going to fight anymore. And you tap, and you realize that sin isn't merciful. Sin doesn't let up. Sin puts its foot on your throat and crushes down. And like this guy, just wouldn't let go when you tap. Sin doesn't let go when you tap, when you give up, when you stop believing you can overcome it. It's not going to be merciful to you. And so we have this hope that we can actually be victorious. And it's not because sin will relent. And it's not a hope that we have Jesus in our corner like a coach for a boxing guy just yelling, you know, get back up, you can do it, kind of. No, we have the power of Jesus actually alive in us, the power that raised Jesus from the dead alive in us to fight against this sin, to renew our minds, change our hearts, change our desires, and fight against this sin that wages war in us. And so we're going to spend the last few minutes here looking at 1 Corinthians 10, verses 12 to 14. It'll be on the screen, but if you want to open a Bible and make some notes, you can, because here is a perfect little sandwich of what we have. We have on the top and bottom layers, the verses, we've got kind of this advice and warnings, and in the middle, we've got this meat of this encouragement about why we can find hope. Here's the message that, again, Paul writes in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 10. He says, "So if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry." So we're going to look at the top and bottom kind of parts of the sandwich after. Let's first look at the very middle in verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. You've got to know you're not alone in what you're struggling with. You're not alone in today's day and age. You're not alone when you look back in Christian history. You're not the first one to be tempted by what you're tempted by, and you won't be the last. There's nothing new under the sun. And because of that, we don't have to fight our struggle on our own. There's no temptation which has overtaken you, which is not common to mankind. When Paul was writing to the Corinthians, there was nothing exceptional about the sin they were facing. It was ordinary. It was things that people had battled with before. They'd encountered it and they'd resisted it. And so these people who he's writing to were to find hope that this sin is beatable, that it is ordinary. It has been encountered and defeated before with the help of God who is faithful. And we mentioned a little bit last week, when you get together with people and we have very private sin, but then you finally let out something that you're going through and somebody else is going through it too, in one sense you find kind of a relief that you're not all alone. But we have to be careful not to take that as kind of a, oh, you yell at your wife, you know, violently? Well, so do I. Well, then it's okay. It's not okay. It doesn't become okay just because two people deal with it, but certainly in that you find some community and support as you try and lift one another out of the muck. And again, when I was at college there, I had this sweet 1991 Chevy S10 two-wheel drive. And when the spring thaw would happen, my wife laughed at that. It was sweet. Red interior. Oh, man. Yeah. It was awful. Anyway. And so I would drive. The spring thaw would happen. And so finally the ground is thawing, and so you'd drive, and the mud was like you'd never seen before. It would throw up chunks of mud way behind the truck. You'd kind of spin down the grid roads. It would be a beautiful thing. And this mud was incredible. You'd walk, and it was so thick, so sticky. You'd walk, and every step you'd grow a half inch. It was a dream come true. And then until you get like 6 inches, literally, you'd be, you know, on these huge platforms, and then it would slop off and you'd start all over again. So of course, when I take my two-wheel drive truck out there, I got stuck. So I slopped my way back to town, got my buddies, got their trucks, we went out to rescue it. And so we got mine out of it, and then we're driving back, and it's kind of dusk, right? Sun's going down, we're in a line, spitting down this road, mud flying out everywhere, and my buddy Jared, he pulls off into the cornfield. And so he pulls off into the cornfield, which has been cut down because it hasn't started to grow yet. And he's spinning all over the place, out this way, mud flinging everywhere. It's a cherry red Ford, right? This is the makings of every country song ever written. And so he is spinning out there. And of course, also a two-wheel drive truck. He gets stuck, but way out there. And so we've got to try and rescue him. And so we've got truck to truck to truck, bumper to bumper to bumper with ropes and chains and everything we have trying to pull each other out. Point is, for both he and I, getting stuck, no problem. On our own, no problem. We had no problem getting stuck in the muck all by ourselves. What we couldn't do, and what you and I can't do with sin, is get out of the muck without some help. That was the experience that we had there. And when it comes to needing help, we need the help of God, who is faithful to get us out. We need the help of community around us, which is why I'm careful to not say, you know, just believe hard enough and you'll be fine. Believe in Jesus and you'll be fine. The power of Jesus is all that you need. Be very clear on that. It doesn't need to be supplemented by anything. But the power of God and his love and desire to transform you may very well happen through community, through groups, through programs, through medical help, right? So if you have issues where you're recognizing a need for more than just some people helping you, then getting help is a good thing. It doesn't mean you lack faith in God's power. God's power may very well be expressed to you through these other means that are made available. So by all means, find help and support. But understand that you're not alone, okay? And find comfort in that, and don't find comfort in that, because you're not alone, but it doesn't make it okay. And so you can change. And it's been experienced before. And we find help with God, who is faithful. And what's God faithful to do in our temptation? Well, check it out. He won't let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. There's amazing promises built in here that it only serves us well to have faith in. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, beyond your ability to resist. Meaning you are capable of fighting off the temptation that seizes you without giving in. Even if you've given in 10,000 times before, it's possible not to this time. I hear that. It is possible. May not feel like it, but God is faithful to make sure it's so. Now that doesn't mean that you on your own with enough kind of focus and willpower are strong enough to make the temptations that you face go away. Doesn't mean that if you believe in Christ enough, it'll be easy, you won't face these difficulties, that resisting will become a natural thing. It's not that if you just believed in God's power a little more, it would help you a little more. What it means is that no temptation is coming upon you which God isn't aware of, and which he isn't limiting to an amount which is within your ability when partnering with him and leaning on his strength to overcome and to withstand and to come out the other side with victory. And we can say, why does God let us be tempted at all? To which there can be a whole host of answers. It may be to help us recognize a need and a willingness to rely on him. It may be to test whether or not we will rely on him based on how he's revealed himself before. It may very well be that we face temptation to remain humble or to receive discipline as a father disciplines a child. There's a number of reasons that we face temptation, but one of them is not that God forgot about you and he's unaware of what's going on and that you're just open season on you from Satan and his demons. That's not what's going on. God is faithful to make sure that you're tempted, but not in a way that's beyond what you can bear. And when you're tempted, he will provide a way out so that you can endure it. And I want you to notice this important detail. The way out isn't to experience this instantaneous relief of pressure from temptation. I mean, if you're right on the cusp of doing whatever it is you do, coping or using your drug of choice, God's promise to provide a way out doesn't mean that right this second something will come along to distract you or to satisfy that craving that you have in a healthier way. The words, it provide a way out so that you can endure it. The way out may very well just be the strength to cling to Him, grit your teeth, and ride it out. Doesn't mean that you're going to feel good immediately. We have the opportunity to endure it, and maybe it's just enough strength to cling to the coattails of Jesus as you walk through this together, and we endure the trial, which is, by the way, a great building of character. This is, we find again and again that having to cling to Jesus in moments of overwhelming temptation and claim His power only grows our understanding and our faith in who He is and what it is that He's capable of. Persevering through trials is a huge way that He helps us in our personal journey towards holiness and in understanding what it is He's called us to and leaning on Him. The point is this, the moment temptation arrives, God is also right there. You are not alone in that moment. You may feel all alone. You may be physically all alone. Spiritually, you're not alone by the grace of God. While there's a spiritual battle going on, the moment temptation arrives in your life, God is there to limit the temptation to what you can bear when you're clinging to His strength and to provide you a way out so that you don't have to give in. That is God's promise, that simultaneous with the arrival of the temptation is the ability for you to lean on Him and find your way out of it victorious. And remember that temptation isn't sin. Just have to remind us of that. Oftentimes, one of the lies of Satan is that you've heard a temptation, you've felt tempted, and the lie of Satan is, well, you've already messed up, so you might as well just go the whole way. And that's just a load. That is garbage, right? Because temptation is part of what it means to be human. Jesus entered humanity, became human. He faced temptation. He didn't give in. It's the giving in that is sin. And so